Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
I'm not saying I don't like police. I'm not saying that. I'm saying I'm just scared of them. Nothing wrong with that. Sometimes we want to call them too.
Where I'm from, seeing cop cars drive down the street feels a lot like low-flying planes in New York City.
I am terrified of them. And if I'm scared of them, imagine how the average, like, 17-year-old black kid feels.
I never wanted to take an innocent person's life.
Not that right!
Save me!
Not that right!
Of course I realize it isn't working, but we're the police, and this is what we do.
Can I shoot this guy? You know, legally, can I? I have to. If I don't, he will kill me if he gets to me.
I can't imagine having the need to call someone for help, knowing that it could ultimately turn into your worst nightmare.
Safety safeguarded by violence is not really safety.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. Last fall, after months of people marching in the streets in the name of Black Lives Matter, we asked our podcast listeners to email us stories about moments in which their desire to see real change were tested. And this week, as Derek Chauvin's trial comes to a close, as we react to yet more death in Minnesota and Chicago, I was reminded of one of the emails we received. It came from a couple in St. Paul, Minnesota, in the Twin Cities, the same area where Dante Wright was just killed, and George Floyd before that, and Philando Castile before that, and just too many others. The email told a small story about a kind of moment that I feel like a lot of people have had lately, maybe a bunch of times if you're like me. It's one of those moments where you realize, you know what, I can do something different here, something new. That's what I heard in this story. So I want to introduce you to two of your fellow listeners.
My name is Julia Udell. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I've been living over here for about 5 years while I've been working on my PhD.
And I'm Grant Edwards, Julia's boyfriend, and I have lived in Minnesota all my life.
All your life?
Yeah. I'm a union pipe fitter, and we live together here in St. Paul.
On Memorial Day weekend last year, Julia and Grant walked out of their house and stepped into a kind of mess. A crowd was gathering in the street around this guy who was yelling and gesturing at a woman in a car. The guy was enraged, and when he started hitting the car seat, Grant saw danger. He grew up around a lot of anger, and he knows it can go pretty bad. So he took out his phone to call the cops, as did several other people who were watching this. But the angry guy, he was also an uncle of one of their neighbors. And this neighbor says, no, no, please do not call the cops. It's one of these things that happens really fast. Everybody's kind of acting on instinct. And Julia, she just walks over to the guy and says, hey, cut it out. You're scaring people. And that works. He just starts to calm down and the whole thing diffuses. But that's just the beginning of the story for Julia and Grant.
Just to kind of like set the scene a bit more, like it's just a gorgeous day. I'm like wearing this like sundress and this like fantastic hat, and I have like
you are
lipstick.
Living your best life.
Yeah, totally. And I just had this feeling that like me showing up in that situation would immediately change the calculus for this guy, because now suddenly he is a black man in a really public place, where everybody is seeing how he's going to respond to this white woman telling him to stop what he's doing. And I was very aware of the racial dynamics here. I knew that I was safe. I was like, just by virtue of the world that we're in, mm-hmm. I felt safe in that moment intervening, because I knew that frankly, the cost for this man to escalate his aggression towards me would be way too high. Mm. And it was it's an awful kind of calculation to do in your head. But the fact was, I knew that I had a good shot at de-escalating whatever was going on without getting injured.
It's interesting because it takes a real honest look at like race and privilege and where everybody involved sits in real time. Like that takes a real uncomfortably honest assessment in a moment of stress.
You know, I've never lived anywhere like the Twin Cities or like Minnesota, where there's like a massive socioeconomic gap between Black people and white people at a scale that I've never seen before. And as somebody who moved here and was able to buy a house after moving here from California, like, and I've rented it out, I've made money off of this house, it's appreciated in value. Like, I am absolutely a gentrifier in this neighborhood. And I'm really the demographic that the city is obviously trying to attract to the area at the expense of the people around me. And I just really just want to live in a way that doesn't add to that pain.
But Grant had a little different reaction to what happened that morning.
After the scene settled down and everybody went their separate ways, I was upset. I was unhappy with Julia's intervention. I think I said something along the lines of, she made a choice to get involved and put herself into danger, which was her choice, but her making that choice pulled me in without really me having say over the matter. And I was concerned that, what if the dude would have had a weapon? So I was kind of unhappy with what happened. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it.
Yeah, we had a pretty heated conversation where I was just saying, like, you know, it was a situation that needed to be de-escalated. And the police aren't actually reliable at doing that. And you also have all of these Black children across the street who see someone who looks like them getting attacked by the police, possibly, or worse. And Grant didn't feel that that was sufficient reason for me to put myself in a dangerous situation, but I did.
But I want to hear Grant speak for himself on that. I mean, was that a compelling answer to you?
At the time, I was new to living in this neighborhood and haven't really lived in very diverse neighborhoods before this. And I didn't really get it. I followed the events of Jamar Clark and Philando Castile and some of the things like that, but I don't think I was touched real personally by that as much. I mean, it was in my hometown, but maybe, I don't know, just didn't have the same experience as maybe living in a neighborhood where that life or death feeling is there. So I didn't really get it. I didn't really agree. I felt like Julia did put herself in a serious amount of danger.
Grant, you kind of talk about this the way you thought then in past tense. How do you feel about this now?
The timing's incredible, not in a good way. So here we are in St. Paul, right next door to Minneapolis. So later, Monday night, the next day, George Floyd was murdered at 35th in Chicago, 36th. And it was like the big news story Tuesday morning. Mm-hmm. So I get up early for my work and I'm on my way to the job and I hear about what happened and I start seeing the viral videos and I'm just horrified and upset and saddened and bewildered. But it made me think of what had happened. I think I was even telling my coworkers about what had happened Sunday. And that context and that shift and witnessing what happened to a Black man at the hands of law enforcement in our metropolitan area was so sobering.
Can I ask, for a lot of people, I think You know, I mean, so obviously George Floyd's murder has become a pivotal moment in a lot of people's consciousness around police violence. But for a lot of people, the question is why? Why was this? You know, why not Philando Castile? Why not any number of the murders before it? And so for you, Grant, what do you think it was about what you saw on the news that morning that made you see something totally different than you'd seen before?
I don't know. I just felt like, I think the slow public way that George Floyd was murdered, just, it's haunting. The way he was held down and the length of time and the pleas and the crowd of people pleading, the 911 dispatcher calling for a supervisor to the situation. It's all tragic, but it sticks with you. I don't know. Yeah.
Julia, can I ask, what made you send us this story? Why did you respond when you heard our call out?
Well, I honestly felt really self-indulgent sending it in, but I guess I just figured I want people to know that stepping in is, like, there is a way to do it that is accessible to every person. Mm. You know, Grant and I were both like, I mean, come on, the things that we said to this guy, it was the campiest stuff ever. It's just like, this isn't how you do conflict resolution. Like, that's it.
Right.
But
it worked because it just interrupted.
Exactly. I just wanted somebody in the world who cares about these things to know that there were folks out here who have no training in restorative justice, who are just trying to keep their neighborhood safe.
Thanks to Julia and Grant for sharing their story. It's nerve-wracking to put your personal business out in the public like that. And I'm glad we can make space for this kind of honest discussion. And I share their story now for a couple of reasons. First, let me say this and get it out of the way. I personally am absolutely sold on the argument that there are way too many police involved in way too many aspects of our lives in every city in this country. Dante Wright is dead now because of an encounter that began with some expired tags and an air freshener. There need to be fewer interactions between people and cops carrying lethal weapons, just period. And a lot of things have to change to make that so. But one thing is our mindset about when and why we call the cops. And for a lot of people, that choice is often more complicated than the political conversation allows. It's awful to feel unsafe. And most people want to know there's some place they can turn when they feel that way. So we'd love to hear more stories from you about this, about moments when you did or did not choose to involve the police in a problem and how it went. Just record a voice memo telling us about it and send it to anxiety@wnyc.org. That's anxiety@wnyc.org. So that's one part of the conversation about when and how police show up in our lives. And for the rest of the show, we're going to talk about why it can go so wrong so fast when they do show up. Later, we'll learn about a pivotal Supreme Court case that some argue has been the primary legal enabler of police violence for decades. But first, I'll talk with a retired detective from the New York Police Department who has argued his profession must evolve or go away.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
wanted to hear from someone with firsthand insights into police culture and just the psyche of police officers. So I'm joined now by retired NYPD detective Mark Claxton. After 20 years on the force, he has been a vocal advocate of criminal justice reform as a co-founder of the organization 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care, and now as part of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance. He said his profession, quote, will either evolve or die. Mark, thanks for coming on the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
So you first joined the NYPD in 1985, which was more than 35 years ago now, and a very different New York City. I just wonder what drove you to join in the first place? Like, in, you know, what were you facing then versus what you faced toward the end of your career?
That's a great question. What compelled me to join the NYPD was my mother. My mother's desire for me to have a good paying job with benefits long term. And I remember as a young man with her saying to me, you know, oh, you'll have an opportunity to retire in 20 years. You have no idea how big that would be. And I didn't at the time. But that was really the motivating factor. That's what really drove me to take the exam. Literally, she drove me to take the exam. Of course, like so many other people, I have a strong desire to help and assist people. That's every cop's answer. But that also played a role. But the determinant factor was my mother's motivating me to do that for the security of it.
I have to ask, Mark, you know, as a Black man who is a former police officer in a moment where we just keep adding to the roll call of Black people who have been killed by police. And now this week, here we are, we have yet another in Minnesota. I just wonder how you process that, what is on your heart with that?
I feel like so many other Black people feel. I feel vulnerable. I feel susceptible. I feel more in danger with every killing, you know, than I've ever felt. I mean, I really feel it. And I'm concerned. I'm concerned for my family. I have sons. You know, I have other family members. So my feelings and part of there are advantages and disadvantages to offering commentary on so many of these cases. The advantages, I get an opportunity to really give some professional perspective to them and to speak to my community specifically about some of the dangers we're facing and some of the dynamics within law enforcement. But the disadvantage is that when it's video, I get to see it over and over and over again. And it seems nowadays, you know, it really has increased my level of fear and concern for my greater community and, of course, my family.
Yeah. Well, thinking about all those years you spent on the force, 2 decades, you know, that's a long time. I wonder what, if anything, changed in the culture of policing over that time? Did it shift at all from the beginning to the end of your career?
You said something that's key, and that is the culture. And since, you know, I've concluded my career with the NYPD, there is not much that has changed police culture. It is still as insulated, as us against them, as no one knows what we do except for us. You know, we're against the world. We defy everything that's outside, any instances of reform, any suggestion about reform or change or update or upgrades. The culture itself, the cliquishness of it, still very much exists. It preceded my career, and it has continued up until this day, from what I can see. I don't think I realized, even during my time in the NYPD, how strong and how toxic the culture was that would prevent any significant or substantive reform. I don't think I grasped it. And there were incidents that occurred throughout my career that I thought, okay, well, this will definitely change things, or this will make a difference, or this will change that behavior or that policy. And then when I saw that it didn't happen, regardless of how egregious and crazy it was.
What do you think that's owing to the sort of stasis in culture in that way? So, because anything else over the course of 30 years, you know, journalism has certainly changed. I think probably almost every profession, people would say, yeah, the culture in my place has changed a lot. Why do you think that's true for policing, that it doesn't change?
Well, I think it's because other professions have national standards, and other professions are constantly evolving to stay updated and current. Other professions consider outside input and are influenced by outside factors. Policing and the profession of policing really remains quite insulated and isolated. The way police look at it is only police know what police do, what police should do, mm-hmm. and how police should do things. So it's a very different culture. It's not a typical profession.
Yeah.
And that's a shame, to be honest with you.
I wonder about how all of that then shows up just sort of in our interactions with police, our individual interactions with police. Over and over again now, we're talking about cops who get afraid and then someone gets hurt or killed. And I genuinely can't understand it. I mean, this is the person who has the gun gets afraid. And it feels easy to say, well, okay, they're racist and they conjure monsters and goblins and they then need to kill those monsters and goblins. But can you help me understand the mindset of a police officer in a moment when they show up on a scene that might lead to these kind of violent interactions we keep talking about?
Well, to be honest with you, fear is quite normal. Fear is a regular companion with police officers on the street. I've had a lot of assignments that are considered to be just dangerous assignments. And there have been many times throughout the course of my police career that I was fearful. The challenge or the requirement of being a professional police officer is how you manage that fear, how you interpret, you know, the events around you in real time, and how you can keep clear head and make wise judgments and assessments in the midst of the most, you know, chaotic or dangerous situations. That's the skill and the art of professional policing. What happens too often is that individual police officers go into situations with perhaps fear, along with ignorance, along with bias, then make decisions based on their general beliefs as opposed to what stands before them. And then a point that I've been making for several years is that we can't ignore the fact that a lot of police enforcement is race-based. So if you start off with race-based enforcement and then you include in that an individual who goes into a certain level of bias, fear, concern, and kind of this stubborn defiance in doing things a particular way, to all of these type of people, you end up with the tragedies that we have ended up with, you know, across the nation.
Well, and that stubborn defiance you talk about, it makes me ask just some fundamental questions about reforming police when you have this kind of culture that you've described, and like what kind of reform is actually possible given that culture. And, you know, in the past year, certainly we've seen this such a shift in mainstream conversation about policing. And it feels like a lot more people just at minimum agree with the idea that police are involved in far too many things, regardless of how they do it. There's just we have too many police in doing too many things. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. But I come from a mindset, I'm comfortable with reimagining policing. I'm very comfortable with it. And I believe it's necessary to do that. In your professions, there is evolution. When you know better, you do better. If there is a better way, you seek that better way. Sometimes that better way decreases your role in society. Sometimes it increases your responsibilities. But I have no problem with reimagining police, because when you think about it, most of the calls that you responded for as a uniformed police officer in patrol deal with, you know, motor vehicle accidents or people who need medical assistance, and you go in there, or if a building is burning down before the fire department gets there, or while the fire department's there, you respond to that. There are a lot of areas that could be handled by people who don't necessarily carry guns, who don't necessarily come with the history and the stigma attached with their appearance. If you delegate some of the responsibilities that are traditionally police responsibilities, you have less interactions with people. You have less opportunity for the police to stop someone for a relatively minor traffic infraction, not even a crime. And somehow this incident during the interaction turned into a fatal shooting or a choking,
right,
or a strangling. But- so I, reimagining police is not only necessary, it's going to, you know, the reform is going to come in one form or another.
How far does that go, though, right? Like, I mean, what about the natural extension of that idea, which is that, like, well, we don't need a we can do better than policing as a model for dealing with our problems in society altogether. We can just start over and not have cops. What about that?
Well, understand, I come to this with a certain bias. And that is because I had a full career in law enforcement. But like I said, I've had many conversations with people who lay out for me, you know, who pose that question and who boxed me in. Just as a matter of fact, 2 weeks ago, Melissa Harris Perry, who used to host on MSNBC.
We've had her on the show.
She posed this question to me and kind of boxed me in to think about it. Well, do you really need the police? My reflex, of course, is, well, yeah, in some capacity, you do need, because there are dangers, et cetera. But I'm open to analyzing and looking at those areas that don't necessarily require a uniform presence with a firearm and the potential danger. And what's sad about that is that the police have put themselves in a position where people are even considering whether or not you're needed, you're necessary. Because of their actions and their refusal to even change or modify their behavior and their decision to place certain communities, particular communities of color, in increased danger, has caused people to say, you know what, you may not be worth all the trouble.
And what's caused people, I mean, certainly for me, part of what's driven me to that is, you know, there have been so many efforts at technocratic reform. And so now here we are. After this shooting in Minnesota, where an officer accidentally drew their gun instead of their taser, and we're debating, like, what's the best way to make officers draw their taser instead of their gun? It just seems absurd. And the question in this for me is, like, is with all of these failed efforts at reform, is it not reasonable to get at a point where we say, well, maybe reform's not possible? Maybe there's something about the culture of this thing that just makes it unmovable.
It is reasonable to question that. It is reasonable. Now, that's where the police will oppose you, because for them, it's not reasonable to even consider it, to have that discussion. But is it reasonable to have it? I think that it is. Nothing changes unless you incentivize or you penalize. That's it. Mm-hmm. It's very simple. So if you have whatever reform idea that you want to move forward, built into it better be incentivizing it or penalizing noncompliance with it. Otherwise, it is a failure. It will not work, because that police don't understand any. They don't understand negotiated settlements and arrangements and modifications to the way things are. They don't even want to even address or deal with or even learn the history of policing. They don't want to know it. It's not relevant to them. So
that's interesting. Even on amongst police officers, you feel like there's not this hunger or desire to know, this is where my profession came from and what it's about.
That curiosity doesn't exist. And part of the reason is because toxic police culture takes that out of you, that curiosity. What matters is right here, right now, us here. That it's cultish in many ways. There's no curiosity to learn the origins of it, because if there was, I would have learned it day one in the police academy. Or right now, there would be police academies teaching the history of police and their slave catching origins. But there's no incentive to learning those type of things, because they're so busy protecting and defending this toxic culture that they have to exist in.
What is the one, it's a silly question because there's not one reform, but if you say, you got to penalize and incentivize, what would that look like? What would be the sharpest version of that?
I tell you, the elimination of qualified immunity is kind of big, even though, it's a civil remedy. But whatever that one thing is, it's hard to go against an entire profession. But if you have individuals within that profession feeling increased vulnerability, increased susceptibility to penalty, then you will see a behavior modification. That's why it's important when you have police officers who engage in conduct under the color of law that you arrest them, you prosecute them, and you sentence them. Because others look at that and go, whoa, wait a second. That's not the department losing $1 million or the taxpayers paying $30 million. That's Joe going to jail next to the guys that he used to arrest.
Yeah.
That will modify behavior in ways that you can't imagine. And then there'll be some people who'll say, I'm not going to the police now because I was going in for a particular reason and I don't want to leave myself open to that type of penalty.
And maybe those are the ones we don't need in policing in the first place.
Exactly. Exactly. It's exactly right. And that's why you have to enforce penalties. You have to be as public about it and as clear about it. And you really have to enforce penalties. That changes everything.
Mark Claxton is the Public Affairs Director for the Black Law Enforcement Alliance and a former NYPD detective with 20 years of service. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, Elie Mystal on the Supreme Court case that a lot of people expected would be a reform for police violence, but actually has become a primary enabler. And that's at the center of Derek Chauvin's defense.
Hi, this is Carolyn Adams, the associate producer for the United States of Anxiety. The onslaught of violence at the hands of police and fellow Americans alike over the past few weeks and months and years has left so many of us wondering, where does this cycle stop? And how can we live with less fear in a world that looks and feels like this? In this week's show notes, we've included two episodes that address these questions. One of them is called, I Did Not Watch the Video, which certainly rings true for me. Author Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya talks about the spectacle of anti-Black violence and challenges all of us to reimagine how we respond to it. So take a listen and let us know what you think on Twitter using the hashtag USofAnxiety or email us a voice note to anxiety@wnyc.org.
We've talked about how the culture of policing feeds a cycle of violence against unarmed Black people, but what about the law itself? How does it incentivize this? Elie Mystal is the justice correspondent for The Nation magazine and a regular on our show. As Derek Chauvin's trial in the murder of George Floyd unfolded, Elie wrote an essay explaining how a 1989 Supreme Court case has become the primary legal enabler of police violence. And he joins us again to explain that history and what can be done about it. Elie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have been watching the trial of Derek Chauvin, and you wrote in The Nation that there's nothing interesting or novel about the defense strategy. His lawyers are arguing simply that police have the right to kill people at their own discretion. So before we get into the legal history behind that argument, just recap the argument itself in the context of this trial. For those who haven't been watching it play by play in the court, explain what you've seen of the defense.
Yeah. And just to be clear, when you say watching, what we really mean is being re-traumatized by police violence behind my head every day for 2 weeks now. Right. Mm. So if you don't have to watch this trial, by all means, like, have an ice cream, do something else with your life. Right. It's not fun. But if you have been watching, there are a couple of threads that the defense is pulling on, but a lot of it is smoke and mirrors, right? It's like, oh, maybe George Floyd was a superhuman, incredible Hulk person that could have beat up four cops while handcuffed and unconscious. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, maybe he was a eggshell tottering drug addict who could have, died if you blew a feather on him. And it just so happened that Derek Chauvin happened to place his knee around his neck area for about 10, but he could have died from anything.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the fence is just kind of doing a lot of like, look at the monkey, look at the monkey, look at the monkey, whoa. But their core legal argument is that Derek Chauvin behaved reasonably on the scene, right? The reason why they're trying to throw out this, like, maybe George Floyd was the Incredible Hulk who could have beat up four cops, or maybe he was just a drug addict who was going to die anyway, is that either way, they're trying to say that what Chauvin did, based on the information he had available, was a reasonable action. It was reasonable to restrain Floyd in that manner. It was reasonable to restrain him for that long, is what they're trying to argue.
And just to lay down the basics here legally, the point here is that the Fourth Amendment is what protects us against violence by the cops, or by the state in general, I guess. And it includes this idea of reasonableness. Explain the Fourth Amendment, like 101.
Fourth Amendment says that the state cannot do unreasonable search and seizure. Now, obviously, the Founding Fathers did not define what unreasonable meant, because the Founding Fathers were some unreasonable white men, right? Like, they
had some, in the first place.
Right? They had some beliefs that would be canceled in this culture. Let's just put it like that. So the way that that phrase, unreasonable search and seizure, was interpreted, has been interpreted for most of American history, is a reasonable man on the street standard. I should add, it is always a man. It has always been a white man, but it is a reasonable white man. What would they do? How would they think? How would they react? That is the standard for unreasonable search and seizure. Over time, the courts have increasingly interpreted that what a reasonable person would expect from the police is, to my mind, quite different than anything that approaches reason, right? Like, already we're in a world where the police can search you and seize you, from patting down your body to forcing you to take a breath. Like, there are all kinds of things that the police can do already that I think question the reasonable man standard.
And the seize part is the violence part, right? Like, is that what I'm to understand? Like, they can't come and beat me up under the Fourth Amendment because that's unreasonable seizure.
Yeah, so seizure is what we call bullets now, I guess. We've determined that, you know, shooting you, beating you up, physically assaulting you, we've determined that is a kind of seizure, which I guess it is, if we're going to use that archaic language, sure. There are occasionally, Callie, and I wouldn't lie to you, there are occasionally, and there was one argument from the Supreme Court this term, cases where the cops argue that shooting people is not seizing them. There was a New Mexico lady that tried to get away in her car. They shot her in the back, but she was able to drive away. And they said that because she was able to drive away, that proves that shooting her three times in the back wasn't a seizure. The cops lost, but they tried it.
Well, I mean, okay, so Supreme Court. You bring us to the Supreme Court. So there's this, we got the Fourth Amendment. It says we're protected against this unreasonable seizure, which may or may not include bullets. But along comes 1989 in a case called Graham v. Connor, which the Chauvin defense team has been citing repeatedly, you point out. And this case is now foundational in deciding when and how cops get to hurt people. So let's walk through the history of that case. Who was Graham and what happened to him that was being litigated?
DeThorn Graham was a diabetic. This is happened in the mid-80s. He went into a store to get some orange juice. He was having an issue. He went into the store. He immediately determined that the line was too long for him to deal with it. I'm sure many New Yorkers have been in that situation. He went back into his car. His friend was actually driving the car. He went back into the car. They drove off. A cop who was outside the store observed a black man walk in the store and immediately walked out and determined at that point that perhaps something suspicious had happened. Perhaps he had done some, I don't know what he would have done, but he trailed DeThorn Graham's car for a couple blocks. Pulled him over. And at this point, you know, with, you know, the slow walk to the car, the let me see your license, blah, 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 DeThorn Graham is now in full diabetic shock. So when they pull him out of the car, again, on suspicion of being in a store and then leaving, that's the stop for being in a store, and, you know, and leaving. They're saying he's resisting. He's in diabetic shock.
Right.
The friend, the driver, is like, look, I have his card. I have his diabetes card. I have his, just give him a drink. Just give him some orange juice. That's all we're trying to do. cops are not listening to him. They decide that Thorne is resisting arrest. They slam his head into the hood of the car, because I don't know what the cops have about slamming heads into hoods, but like, it's like why they joined the force.
It's a thing.
Right? Slam his head into the hood of his car, try to get him into his car. He's freaking out at this point. Break his foot, get him down to the ground. At which point, another cop actually goes to the store, which says, no, nothing happened, and they let him go. That was the seizure.
That was the seizure.
That was the seizure that happened to the Thorne Graham. So he sued for, you know, excessive force, violation of his rights, blah, blah, blah. Pointedly, he sued under the 14th Amendment. He said this was a racial biased stop. When the case got to the Supreme Court, and I'll save you the procedural history, when the case finally got to the Supreme Court, the conservatives on the court, led by William Rehnquist, they converted his claim from a 14th Amendment, these cops were racist claim, to a 4th Amendment, these cops conducted an unreasonable search and seizure claim, which just, I think that's always important to remember that this case that changes the way police can use force wasn't even what the man asked for. Right. So just remember that. Anyway, right. They converted to a 4th Amendment claim, and then they say, the Supreme Court says, unanimously, by the way, this decision ended up including liberals, that the standard should not be what a reasonable person would do, because obviously a reasonable person would not beat the crap out of a diabetic. Mm-hmm. That's, can't argue that. The standard should not be what a reasonable person should do. It should be what a reasonable cop on the scene should do. And that changed everything, man.
And why does that change everything? Explain why that's such a big difference.
Because now the standard for cop violence is whether another cop would be violent, right? Mm-hmm. So like, it's like saying, well, the standard of food is what my dog would eat. Well, mm-hmm. that's not, that completely changes what food is now, doesn't it?
Right.
The cops now, all the cops have to say, as long as this cop stick together, right? As long as the next cop and the next cop and the next cop says like, oh, I would have beat up the Thorne Graham. Oh, I would have definitely broken his foot. Oh, I would have broke 2 feet.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, you see how that violence kind of, it's literally a situation where violence begets violence. Now, the reason why the liberals signed on, I'll give them some, you know, I'm not going to completely trash them. The reason why the liberals signed on is because before Graham v. Conner, the standard was that you had to show that the cops acted unreasonably under the reasonable man standard. But you also had to show that they kind of intended to harm you, right? They had to have a malicious intent when they were beating the crap out of you or whatever. And liberals felt like that was too high of a standard, right?
Because you could never prove intent.
Right, the cop would, I didn't mean to break his foot. It just happened when I was beating him up. So the liberals thought that by moving it to a reasonable cop standard, you were actually making it easier to bring excessive force cases against the police. But, you know, history has shown that they've just made it harder, because the cops always stick together and they always tell each other, oh, this is reasonable, this is reasonable, this is reasonable. And we can only judge, they're basically saying we can only judge police action based on police action, right? As opposed to based on something objective.
Well, and what shifted for me a bit in my thinking when I read this piece, because I didn't know about this case, is that when we hear these arguments about how, you know, monstrously super strong fill in the blank black person was when they got killed by the police, you know, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, we're hearing it again with George Floyd, as you point out, that it's not just about smearing the victim. It's not just about like these sort of rhetorical racism. It's literal legal racism, because it's setting up this argument.
Exactly. And then that's, I mean, I'm so glad you said that, because that's kind of why I wrote the piece, right? They're not being racist idly is the point, right? Like, there is a legal incentive for them to have this kind of racial bias in their arguments, because the whole I feared for my life thing, that comes from Graham v. Conner. What would a reasonable officer do if they feared for their life? Well, it doesn't have to be a reasonable fear for their life. It has to be what another cop would fear for their life, right? So, like, all of that gets warped. And so, like, trying to supercharge, superhumanize, and smear, frankly, the victim on the scene is how cops actually get away with it.
As we have seen.
Right? I think it's one of the most wrongly decided cases in the Supreme Court canon that doesn't get talked about a lot, partially because people don't know about it, but also because when you say it without the backstory, it sounds basically fair, right? Mm-hmm. Like, well, I'm just a regular Joe. What do I know about, you know, law enforcement? Surely the standard should be what other law enforcement would do, not what an average guy in the street. No, it should not be that. Yeah. It should be what an other, what a reasonable citizen should do. The Fourth Amendment was written to protect citizens from the police, not protect the police from accountability. It's a warping of the Fourth Amendment, the way Graham v. Connor has come out. But, you know, I'm not on the Supreme Court, so it doesn't matter.
But you are a lawyer and a Supreme Court scholar, and it begs a more fundamental question for me, Ellie, which is like this idea that we turn to courts and the law for justice on stuff like this in the first place maybe is a failing effort. It, you know, that every time that the loss, the disappointment that people feel at the end of these police prosecution trials is baked in. And I guess, I don't know, I just want you to respond to that. Is that true? How do you feel about that? Is this, are we looking in the fundamentally wrong place for justice when we look to the courts for this?
I mean, it's a tough question because I guess my initial reaction is the criminal justice system is the worst possible system except for all the other ones that have been tried, right? Okay. I have no love for our current criminal justice system, but when you think about ending it, right, when you think about really, you know, here's a great example, Kai, I've written about elsewhere. Think about the jury pool, right? Now, I have argued about this trial, about the Derek Chauvin trial, that I think the entire trial is performative. I think the decision on guilt or acquittal was baked in the moment they sat the jury. I don't know which way it's baked in. Mm. But the way that we select juries in this country is completely racially biased. To get on the Derek Chauvin jury, you had to generally not know anything about the case. Well, think about it this way. If you're the kind of person who lives in Minnesota and doesn't know why hundreds of thousands of black people around the country are protesting, then you're already susceptible to cops get to kill black people whenever they want.
Yeah.
Like, you're already biased if you somehow have remained ignorant about why this trial is taking place, right? But that ignorance is literally the threshold issue to get onto this jury. That's wrong, right? That's a bad jury system. However, the system of picking juries and having juries decide these cases goes back to, and I am not being hyperbolic, Athens. All right, this is the best that humans have come up with for 3,000 years. So as much as I can look at our jury system and be like, this is terrible, this is wrong, you know, the Star Chamber, like, shows up, or, you know, just Spanish inquisitors torturing people. Like, the humans have just done worse than this, not better. So, you know, is the criminal justice system the right way of handling issues of state-sponsored violence? No, but give me a better one, because I think about this a lot, and I haven't come up with one yet. All I can come up with is ways to make this system not racist.
Well, along those lines, is there a political fix to Graham v. Connor? How do we fix Graham v. Connor then, barring a Supreme Court deciding they were wrong?
You want the possible issue or you want the right answer?
I want the right answer.
The way to fix Graham v. Connor is through legislation. We should have a national use of force guideline promulgated by the federal government that should apply to every single police locality. And if the Supreme Court says that is unconstitutional because some federalist concern, then we should pack justices on the Supreme Court until we get enough who think that it's constitutional. Period. End of story. We cannot live in a country. We can no longer live in a country where the use of force is defined by the police, and it's defined differently by the police depending on which side of a county line I happen to have a broken taillight in. Like, that just has to stop. Now, what should that new legislative standard be? That's where you get into a lot of different, I think, arguments and concerns. You know, California made an effort to change their state standards, and the police unions fought it bitterly. You know, cops argue that if you change the standard, if you make it so that you have to be right with 20/20 hindsight, cops might hesitate on the job. And that's what I want. I want cops to hesitate before they shoot people. So my standard would be what I call reasonable in fact. If you think that the suspect has a gun and you shoot him, he better have a gun. Because if he doesn't, it should be automatic, strict liability, jail time for you. You don't get an opportunity to be wrong, right? If you think he had a gun and you shoot and it's a cell phone or a wallet or a refracted, gas off of a planet, then guess what? You go to jail. End of story. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. That would be my standard. That would be quite a different thing. That would make cops hesitate. Yeah. That would make cops hesitate before they shot me or my kids. That's what I want. That's not what cops want. So I would set the standard at objectively correct. Other reformers will allow for some leeway for cops kind of trying their best in a quick and difficult situation. But whatever we do, we need to change the standard for when cops are able to deploy deadly force.
Ali Mistal is the justice correspondent for The Nation magazine and a regular on this show. Thanks for coming back, Ali.
Thanks for having me.
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Jared Paul mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Jenny Casas, Karen Frillman, and Christopher Wirth. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Carolyn Williams is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And as always, please do join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Till then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.